of surveillance by the Israeli government. Can you lay out? I don't think people understand the extent of what Palestinians live under, what you lived under in Gaza.
Thank you so much for having me. At first, I think, you know, we've been living with a question for so long, even that goes long before this war started. And it's been life under and inside, you know, a state of like where surveillance is constant. You know, it's automated and it's largely invisible. And as a reporter, I've seen like a lot of coverage focusing on weapons and airstrikes and technology. But I think much less attention was paid to the systems that decide who is seen and how they're doing this in effect to the human life and the civilian population in Gaza, and how they're categorizing people, and how quickly and deadly life and death decisions can be made. And so that was the reason I wanted to understand what that feels like from the inside. And so in the story, I tried to report this, you know, away from being political, technological, or a military story, but as a human one. I spoke with families who described living with the sense that they were always being watched, they're always being heard and scored, and even, you know, in moments that should be private and ordinary. And that constant awareness, how it's reshaping how people speak, how they're moving, how they're even thinking. And there was also a sense of urgency because, like, you know, these systems are no longer experimental, right? They're, you know, they're being, you know, operational, they're being scaled up, and they're, you know, deeply embedded in life in Gaza. And once something like this becomes normalized in one place, it rarely stays there. And so, you know, as a result of my reporting, I have come to realize that Gaza, you know, it's been the testing ground for how surveillance can be used, an entire population in real time.
Mohammed, could you talk about some of the specific examples? For instance, you write about a woman named Mary, a 26-year-old writer who woke up in the middle of the night on July 27th with a drone flying in her room while she was sleeping. Give us some of these specific examples.
Of course. I mean, people, you know, some of them told me and described to me a kind of a permanent self-monitoring, you know, in the aftermath of encountering these decisions and these systems and these, you know, regimes of being watched. And, you know, they're saying, like, you know, life starts to feel like you're always leaving a trail, sometimes of words, movements, associations that could later be misinterpreted. So in the story, people talk about, you know, changing how they speak on the phone, how they're avoiding certain phrases, certain conversations, certain ideas or topics, even in private, and they're limiting who they can contact. And you know, because sometimes even it's true that they're assuming that even silence can be suspicious. What I've also learned through speaking with these people is that, you know, I had known, like, surveillance observes behavior and it limits action, but it was also for the people in Gaza, it produced different behavior. It manufactured behavior for people. So they shrink their lives to reduce risk. They rehearse what version of themselves feels safest to present. And that creates an, you know, an enormous psychological burden.
Mohammed, and you know, following up on what Juan said, this woman, Mary, 26-year-old writer, I don't think people understand the specifics. You say a dark square hovered near the ceiling. She stared at it motionless until it drifted out of the room, exited through a window. We're talking about a drone. Mary said, it's not exactly death that we fear. It's the terror that comes before it. A tiny drone hovering over her head?
Absolutely. That's correct. It's only one example of the many stories I've heard from people who had to encounter and who have come to experience this level of surveillance that is so deep in their lives, including, you know, a technological sort of a machine that goes inside the house and roaming, you know, what's supposed to be a private or secure space for people. So this woman who's a writer in Gaza, she woke up one night, you know, during the war in Gaza, only to realize that there is a drone that was watching her and her family, and it was just, you know, freely roaming inside the house. And at some point, it exited through the window. And that was one defining and a very reshaping moment in her lives and like in the family's also behavior in the aftermath. Some other people describe being encountered with cameras at checkpoints, for example, aside from, you know, their direct, you know, engagement with these drones that are hovering constantly overhead. And they were realizing that, you know, there is a massive file that was so deep, inclusive of information that they never imagined that would be known for others, you know, for other people, aside from private contacts, aside from, you know, family, immediate family, neighbors. And so it was so deep to the point that people were shocked to know that there were, you know, seen and watched for a long time that goes beyond only a week or two or a month.
And Mohammed, could you talk about the role of the major tech companies like Microsoft, Palantir, Google, as well in this surveillance state?
I think one of the central findings of my reporting and of course, and of other investigations I reference in the piece is that this surveillance ecosystem, it doesn't exist without massive computational infrastructure, right? We're talking about, you know, cloud storage, data processing, AI-assisted analysis, and that's where large technology companies come in, including American firms that provide cloud and computing services with the Israeli government and the Israeli military. And so I was in the story, I was very careful not, you know, to claim that any single company is pulling the trigger. But that's also not, you know, I think the right sense of urgency that we have here. The real issue is that the infrastructure, when companies provide the storage, the processing power, the scalability of these systems that allow population-level surveillance to function, they become part of the system that makes this kind of control possible. Because I don't think, you know, cloud services are neutral here in this, you know, question. They determine speed, they determine scale and persistence, and they allow massive data sets, phone metadata, location histories, social graphs, to be stored indefinitely and analyzed continuously. What's interesting is also, like, you know, most of these companies responded by saying they comply with the law, that they have internal safeguards, and that they haven't found evidence that their tools were used to directly harm civilians. But the problem is that much of this activity happens inside classified or opaque military pipelines, and you know, which is like making the case that independent auditing is nearly impossible here. So the accountability gap is structural, and it's really big. When harm emerges from a system rather than a single action, I think here responsibility becomes, you know, diffuse, and that's exactly what makes it dangerous for people.
Looking at this harrowing excerpt of your piece, on December 6th, I went home to check on my family. Shortly after I walked in, a caller speaking Arabic introduced himself as David from the Israeli, military. He called me Habibi, which means my dear in Arabic, and said we had 20 minutes to evacuate our three-story house crowded with family and neighbors. It felt like another form of harassment. We decided to stay, so next morning around 7:30 a.m., I heard my son's feet patter down the hallway as I was reaching for my tea. The blast came without warning. The house folded in on itself. I didn't see the ceiling crack or the walls fall. Just a sudden weight, concrete and metal, pressing me flat, my arms pinned. I called out for my wife, for my son, for my parents. At first, nothing, then a small voice from somewhere I couldn't reach. Baba. You talk about this happening to you as a Palestinian journalist in Gaza City. Can you continue what happened that day?
The very early moments in the aftermath of the strike, we were just, I remember, you know, being buried in under the rubble of the house and, you know, just like hearing a few hours later after realizing that I had passed out, you know, rescue people. Paramedics and first responders and neighbors were trying to pull us out, you know, from under the rubble and taking us to first aid treatment at the, you know, the hospital that day when we were, you know, sent back because, like, we were dealing with a very shortages of you know, medical system and the collapse of the whole medical system in Gaza. So all we were offered at that day was first aid treatment, and we were sent back to stay at a neighbor's place before we started to bounce around the city across makeshift shelters. It was a story of the many stories that I had, you know, to experience. But this time it was happening to me as a result of my work as a journalist in Gaza. I've heard similar stories from colleagues and reporters and friends who were killed after they were being tracked and watched and threatened to stop their work. In my case, it was explicitly direct that I was receiving these threats to stop my journalism and reporting. What made me realize that it is also very tied to surveillance and I was being watched and tracked is that before, like, for a week before the bombing happened and my house was destroyed, I had been away a week or so, like reporting from outside the house and running across the city with, you know, other colleagues and journalist friends. As soon as I set foot in the house, my phone rang and I received this call from a stranger who identified himself as a, you know, David from the Israeli military and who urged us to leave the house. I didn't leave that day, and I think it was mainly because I didn't really realize how serious he was. I mean, for someone calling me Habibi, which is a very endearing way of calling friends and loved ones in Arabic, I didn't realize that he was actually trying to kill me. And so I thought maybe this was another harmful, spamful call to, you know, stop me from my work and just, you know, silence me. And it was scary enough to make me realize that I have to stop reporting at least for a week or two in the coming, you know, days. But I didn't really know that it was to the point that they were actually intending to bomb the house, including on top of all of us. Like we were always, like we were almost 30 people or around that in the house, including immediate and extended family members and neighbors and people who had fled from different parts of the city to seek refuge in the neighborhood. And so this is a layer and this is a pattern of targeting that happened to me and to many others as well in Gaza.
Mohammed,
and that was, yeah.
I want to thank you for being with us. It's an incredible piece and I want to encourage people to read it. Mohammed Mahawish is a Palestinian journalist and writer from Gaza City. The piece is in New York Magazine, headlined Watched, Tracked and Targeted: Life in Gaza Under Israel's All-Encompassing Surveillance Regime. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Coming up, the Trump administration intensifies its immigration crackdown. Wealthy visa applicants can now buy $1 million Trump gold card or a $5 million Trump platinum card to live in the U.S. as others are deported. Stay with us.
Money talks, money shouts. Don't take much to hear. Like it or not, you need a lot if you're gonna make a life down here. Money talks, money spits, makes its presence felt. Wanna be broke? This is no joke when you're dealing with the cards you're dealt. Now the love of money took many a man the path to greed and vice. The reward's in heaven if you wait that long.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. As the Trump administration expands its immigration crackdown around the country, President Trump's making it easier for a select few to obtain a U.S. visa. Earlier this week, Trump officially launched a program that provides a pathway for wealthy non-citizens to receive expedited permission to live and work in the U.S. For $1 million payment, visitors can obtain a Trump gold card that promises to fast-track U.S. residency applications in record time. The administration says it'll soon offer a $5 million Trump platinum card, allowing visitors to also avoid paying some U.S. taxes. Meanwhile, new U.S. Customs and Border Protection rules published this week would require visitors from 42 countries on the visa waiver program to provide up to 5 years of their social media history history, along with telephone numbers, email addresses, and biometric data, including DNA, face, fingerprint, and iris scans. We're joined now by Shev Dalal Dehaney, Director of Government Relations at the American Immigration Lawyers Association. This is a stunning new development. If you can talk about what these two groupings are, one who will be fast-tracked to live in this country if you could afford between $1 and $5 million to get your Trump Platinum or Gold card, and the other group, who normally can come in and out, like, let's say, people from Spain, of the United States, now have to give 5 or 10 years of social media information, telephone numbers they have used, biometric data. Explain.
Yeah, good morning, and thank you for having me. I think what this is clearly indicating is we're showing a very clear sign of what the Trump immigration policy is. If you're wealthy, if you can pay to play, then you're welcome to come to the United States. But if you're not, if you're coming as a tourist or you're, you know, coming to seek humanitarian protection, then we're going to make it much tougher for you to come here and really put a lot of hurdles along the way in the guise of security and vetting.
And could you talk about how this is turning upside down the historic understanding of what immigration was to the United States? To what degree does the administration need any authorization from Congress to institute these changes?
Look, I mean, I think Congress sets forth our immigration laws. That is their responsibility. And you can't create a new visa category like the gold card or the platinum card just by executive order only. That's not heard of. Only Congress has that authority. You know, we are really concerned about the fact that there is no legal authority. We don't even know what the legal analysis is behind this gold card, because typically, as I said, Congress sets forth the policy, the laws, and the agency interprets those laws. But when it interprets those laws, they have to do detailed analysis about how this will work, what are the requirements, how is it justified under existing laws, and then what's the economic impact of these new proposals. We have nothing. All we have is a website and a form.
So you had this kind of news conference this week with Lutnick sitting next to President Trump. And you had these comments of Lutnick. Let's bring in the top of the best. Let's help them grow America and build America. Why should we take people who are below average? And then you have the Trump Platinum card, the Trump Gold card. And you have then all this information that countries where people usually come and go from the United States have to now give. Who is going to take in this information, this massive amount of information of all the social platform addresses people have, handles people have, phone numbers people have had? What do they do with this?
Yeah, so to your first point, right, I just wanted to make clear, we are already bringing in the best and the brightest in the United States. The visas, the numbers that the Trump card is going to take away are being taken away from recipients of EB-1 and EB-2 visas, which are for people of extraordinary ability or those who are in our national interest. Those are Nobel Prize winners, award-winning artists and athletes, multinational CEOs, doctors, and engineers. So, you know, the best and the brightest who are contributing to American society are already coming here, and they are already doing what we need them to do. Now, to your second question about the social media vetting, this is just a real, like, fishing expedition, right? There is no evidence that we have seen that combing through years and decades, and in certain instances, they're asking for, you know, your last email addresses for 10 years and your phone numbers and the family history. That does nothing to discover a possible, you know, security risk or a terrorist. And so I think what it's only going to cause is a lot more delays in our legal immigration system. It's going to create backlogs. It's going to take the time and energy of people who are supposed to be adjudicating these cases at USCIS, at CBP, at the Department of State. And have them focus on really what I said before, a fishing expedition.
Abdullah Dahaney, we will continue to follow this. Thanks so much for being with us. Director of Government Relations at the American Immigration Lawyers Association. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Democratic lawmakers repeatedly called on Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem to resign as they confronted her on Trump's immigration crackdown during a heated House Homeland Security Committee hearing Thursday. Noem's opening statement was briefly interrupted by protesters.
I'm looking forward to discussing the worldwide threats that this country faces and the work that President Trump and his administration does each and every day to make America safe again. I'm very privileged and honored today to have my family with me. I'd like to introduce them to you.
Disruptions of congressional business is a violation of law, is a criminal offense under federal law. Audience members are advised to take their seats and maintain order. The chairman may now ask Capitol Police to remove and arrest the persons creating a disturbance.
Get ICE off our streets! Stop terrorizing your community! Get ICE off our streets! Stop terrorizing your community! Get ICE off our streets! Stop terrorizing your community!
During the hearing, Congressmember Delia Ramirez of Chicago, the daughter of Guatemalan immigrants, announced she's taking the first steps to impeach Kristi Noem.
You lied on the record. And you lied to members of this committee. You violated court orders by not turning around deportation flights bound for El Salvador, where we know that hundreds of people under your leadership have reported that they were raped, they were beaten, and they nearly died. And your agents used chemical weapons in Chicago despite court orders from District Court Judge Ellis forbidding their use. Secretary Noem, you, Gregory Bovino, and your ICBP and DHS deputized agents have waged an unaccountable, unlawful, unconstitutional war against communities across the nation. Our residents have been surveilled, they've been threatened, they've been tear gassed, they've been hit with pepper balls, they've been shot, they've been subjected to warrantless arrests and precision immobilization maneuvers, they've been kidnapped and disappeared under your leadership. Bottom line, you lie with impunity. You reject checks and balances, and you ignore Congress and the courts. Your options are limited. Either you're going to resign, Trump's going to fire you, or you will be impeached. I've already called for your resignation. You may remember I hand-delivered my request to you back in May, and I urge you to reconsider resignation because I've taken the first step towards your impeachment, and I've called on the Judiciary Committee to open an investigation into your lawlessness.
That was Congressmember Delia Ramirez of Chicago, who joins us now. Congressmember Ramirez, that was a fiery hearing yesterday. Explain what it would mean for Kristi Noem, the Secretary of Homeland Security, to be impeached.
Look, Amy, it would mean that we would actually go through the process and initiate the process through an investigation and then an impeachment committee to look at all of the things that have happened under her leadership over this last year that are impeachable offenses, to establish the articles necessary to bring before the body in Congress the actual vote to impeach her. It would mean, in essence, remove her. We've called for her resignation. You know, Amy, I've been calling for her resignation since May. Now other members of Congress, Democrats, are calling for the resignation, but we're past resignation. We actually need to look at everything she's done, the ways that she's committed offensible, impeachable crimes as a secretary, and actually move to a full formal impeachment, in which it would mean that she would not be able to work as secretary, but also in any of his leadership positions.
And Representative, I wanted to ask you about a new report today in the media in terms of ICE claiming in response to a Freedom of Information request from the Freedom of the Press Foundation that they have no records of any videos that they took during Operation Midway Blitz in Chicago. Your reaction to this assertion by ICE?
I mean, I'm no longer surprised, right? And let's be clear, we can't normalize any of this, but they are operating as a criminal organization, the Department of Homeland Security, under her leadership. Of course, all of a sudden, they don't have any footage, because the footage would show that what in fact happened via Midway Blitz was to me, the highest offense of criminality under the leadership of Christine Ohm. Someone got killed, shot and killed under her leadership. People were dragged out of their cars. They were beaten. They were disappeared. And what we also saw was that these agents that were weaponized across the city of Chicago and suburbs were identifying people, abducting, beating, and attacking them based on the color of their skin. We also know what we saw at Broadview Detention Center repeatedly, the way that ICE pepper ball attacked, used these immobilization techniques to harm people. All of that was excessive force and illegal in many ways. And video footage, if they showed it, would show it. Fortunately, the people, the community had a lot of that footage that was used in courts to demonstrate that what she has done is unconstitutional, unlawful, and has violated her oath as Secretary of Homeland Security.
And in terms of the killing that you mentioned, could you talk a little more about what has been discovered since then about what the ICE agents claim the woman was assaulting them and the facts as have come out afterward?
You know, they said that the woman, Marimar, had assaulted agents and assaulted Bovino, when we actually, in fact, know that, no, she had not shot at them. They shot at her not once, five times. This is a force of terror. That is what we are seeing. And what we saw from my colleagues on the other side of the aisle in committee yesterday was a thank you tour. Every single one of them thanking her for committing crimes, thanking her for violating the rule of law, thanking her for killing people based on the color of their skin, thanking her for disappearing people in detention, thanking her for the people who have died in ICE custody. We know that more than 25 people have died. And when I asked her about the 170 at least American citizens have been detained under her leadership, you know what she did? She laughed at it. Because she thinks that she is above the law as long as Republicans are in leadership. And that's why, to me, it's so important for Democrats to be using every single authority, whether it's in committee, whether it's on the floor or in investigations, to hold them accountable. We can't allow her to think this is a laughable matter as people are dying under her watch.
I wanted to ask Congressmember Delia Ramirez, if there is a move among Congress members to support Ilhan Omar and object to President Trump's comments, calling a sitting Congress member garbage. I remember when Adelita Grijalva was not seated, Congress members like you, especially Congresswomen, stood up and demanded that she be seated after she was elected. What about with Ilhan Omar now, to say the least, under assault from these extremely inflammatory comments?
Yeah, no, look, a number of us have talked about establishing a resolution that confirms that we stand in solidarity with Ilhan Omar, that we will not allow the president to use his authority to attack her, to put her life in danger, and call her to question a sitting member of Congress from Minnesota because of her hijab, because of where she was born. We know that it is setting dangerous precedent. It may start with Ilhan. Certainly some of us, they have attempted and talked about deporting us, denaturalizing us. I was born in this country, and they still say this. And it's not Donald Trump, just Donald Trump.
We have five seconds.
Donald Trump is using Andy Ogles and others. So it is our responsibility to stand with Ilhan because it's standing with the body and the House of Representatives.
And of course, he didn't just call Ilhan Omar garbage. He called the whole Somali community in the United States. Congressmember Delia Ramirez, Democratic congressmember from Illinois, member of the House Homeland Security Committee. That does it for our show. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
This is Mac DeMarco, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby, the Chablis.
For many, a career in music is a dream come true. However, the reality is that many people in the Canadian music industry do not have access to medical benefits and financial aid. This is especially true for our music industry veterans, and it's why the Unison Fund created the Slate Family Foundation Legacy Program. To learn more on how you can support legacy artists and musicians who are coping with unexpected or chronic illness, visit unisonfund.ca.